Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Reason Weekend. It is awesome. I haven't seen this much excitement in the morning since I think my first AA meeting. I'll be working all weekend, apparently, here. So welcome to Santa Barbara. As David Knott was mentioning last night, Santa Barbara has a lot of great resonance for the history of Reason, which we will get into tonight with a great conversation with Bob Poole and Tipper McCann and Manny Klausner, which I'm super duper excited about. It also has a resonance and nostalgia with me that I'm going to inflict upon you now in the guise of talking about the modern unfree speech movement that we're dealing with. So I went to school at UC Santa Barbara. This is an iconic image of it, 12 miles to the north here. That is Stork Tower, where Hunter S. Thompson may or may not have engaged in illicit activities in 1987. If I remember correctly, over here, was the place where I learned how to do journalism, at the UC Santa Barbara Daily Nexus. At the time, it was one of the five or so best daily newspapers in the country. The year, a few months before I joined the staff in 1986, they had published a series of exposés showing that the chancellor, then chancellor of university, had misused and appropriated university funds to build a new bathroom and a bunch of other kinds of weird, corrupt things. A series of exposés that eventually put him in jail and got him out of the chancellorhood, Robert Huttenbach, who incidentally is the uncle of Mickey Kaus, for those of you who like weirdness. The Nexus seated a lot of people. The managing editor of the LA Daily News for a long time is a former Nexite. The woman who works for the ACLU, who talks to Edward Snowden every day on a selfie stick, is a former person I worked with there. All kinds of interesting guy who ran Sony Pictures publicity for 20 years. A very thoroughgoing, wonderful place where I learned a lot about journalism. It wasn't the only part there. So Thomas Stork, of whom this is named for, is a great old character in Santa Barbara and California history. If any of you can find it in a used bookstore or online, there's a great book that he wrote called California Editor, talking about his time. He bequeathed this area as a gigantic free speech factory, basically. So you have the Daily Nexus right there. You have KCSB, the campus radio station, which brought the world, or inflicted upon the world, people like Jim Rome and Steve Zabin, among others, which is all funny because it was basically a bunch of old commies playing like folk music from Cuba. But you have these shock jocks that came out of it. Thomas Stork had this great idea about free speech. He was the publisher of the Santa Barbara Daily News, which was a Democratic paper in the early 20th century. The Republican paper, called the Santa Barbara Press, was always foundering, and in the onset of the Great Depression, they really are desperate to have a buyer for it. And so they sold it to Thomas Stork, and so the guy, you know, what are you gonna do if you have both newspapers here in town? You're gonna combine them, right? No, he didn't. He thought, well, you know what, if we have a Democratic paper, there's enough Republicans in this town, we should have a Republican paper too, and even though it loses money, I think it's more important for the quality of the debate to have both papers. So for 6 years during the Depression, he ran both newspapers, one of which was bleeding money, and he did it from his own concept of free speech. Eventually, they did merge and become the Santa Barbara News Press much later. But anyways, he bequeathed this great space and sort of a great sense of freedom to the UC Santa Barbara campus, which extended beyond just the little media center there. The film school there is very interesting. It's highly theoretical, and I swear it's good, even though it did produce Gwyneth Paltrow. There's a College of Creative Studies started by crazy hippies in the 70s, I think it was, where you don't get grades. You just have to show up and constantly produce work, art, music, a bunch of stuff. A lot of great musicians came out of that. So at the time that I was going there in the late 1980s, it was this font of great sort of discussion and production of free speech material. We had our share of controversies, to be sure, some of which we'll get into later. I recall my freshman year, a little gentleman named Eric Boucher, who was dating a copy editor at the Nexus, but whose stage name was Jello Biafra, and he was a crazy punk rocker. He came in and gave a a huge lecture about why I'm glad the space shuttle blew up, which created some kind of controversy at the time. Blue Velvet, the movie, was out that year, and there was a big, vigorous debate on campus about whether it was objectifying women and Isabella Rossellini and things like that. There was a new feminist movement, a group called You Can't Keep a Good Woman Down, and I was covering all this at the campus newspaper, it was fascinating, who went into a crappy liquor store called SOS Liquor, which probably is still standing, and tore down, I think they were topless, if I have this correctly, so they were topless, and they came into the SOS Liquor store and tore down St. Pauli Girl posters. Remember the St. Pauli Girls were like, eh? Because they were objectifying and dehumanizing to women. And so we dealt with a lot of these kind of vibrant free speech issues, and usually on the end, especially at the newspaper, but elsewhere, the kind of notion that, hey, look, this is a open brawl, this is how, you know, we move the needle on things, that's the best outcome. So for example, this obscure person named Sean Hannity, who worked at KCSB, was charged with being anti-gay, hate speecher, because he compared homosexuality to bestiality and said, you know, anyone who believes that homosexuality is normal is a crazy person and you shouldn't listen to him. And so there's a big debate, and the Daily Nexus, whose nickname, by the way, was Commie Rag, so it gives you a sense of its of its politics, generally speaking, although we altered that during my tenure, for sure. Leapt to the guy's defense and said, hey, look, you know, we should have, in addition to lesbian folk ballads from the Soviet Union, we should also be able to have guys like Sean Hannity. He eventually was kicked off the air at that time in a divided vote, and maybe a precursor of things to come. So I use this all as a backdrop. UC Santa Barbara was a very interesting place, a cradle of kind of free speech and debate, things like that. And now I'm going to subject you to a wonderful recent TV video for 4.5 minutes, which also takes place in UC Santa Barbara, that tells us how far we've backslid in some ways on free speech on college campuses. Gentle boys, do you have our recent TV video?
What's harm in giving just a small warning?
Certain scenes do trigger certain emotions.
It's really not anyone else's business to tell someone when they are mentally and emotionally ready to deal with things.
If you create a sort of a sense of a duty for a professor not to say anything that potentially could trigger an emotional response from students, you are really severely limiting the world in which a professor can teach.
Have you ever been shocked by a violent or disturbing scene in a movie, book, or on the internet?
Get me up. Let me sink.
Maybe you could have used a trigger warning.
So a trigger warning warns you about content you might be facing that could provoke a response based on symptoms of PTSD.
The concept of the trigger warning first gained popularity among feminist and social justice blogs, some of which include extensive lists of possible triggers, ranging from depictions of rape and abuse and war to needles and snakes and small holes. One site even lists potential triggers in films, such as American Psycho, which contains gore, murder, and sexual violence against women, or It Takes Two, which alludes to the death of a parent, child abuse, and child labor. A few enterprising college students are now pushing to bring trigger warnings to the classroom.
I was in a classroom, it was a very small, intimate classroom, and we were watching a film, and there were several scenes of sexual assault, and finally a very drawn-out rape scene. It did not trigger me. I recognized the potential for it to be very triggering.
Bailey Loverin is a student at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And while Oberlin has attracted a fair amount of media attention with its wide-ranging list of triggers that encompass racism, colonialism, religious persecution, violence, suicide, and more, it's actually Loverin's more focused UCSB initiative that's gotten the most traction, passing the student assembly and soon to be implemented as a mandate for all professors.
I don't feel like it's a problem asking for this to be mandated, that this should be an official policy. You're always going to have someone that's going to argue, why? This is ridiculous. I shouldn't have to do this because I don't feel it. Why should anyone else? While the majority of people are already willing and actually implementing this in classrooms, this reaches out to the people that have not yet done so.
If universities had a trigger warning saying, if you want to go to universities, then be careful, there might be stuff that triggers you, you know, that would be sort of absurd at some level. But ultimately, if you're going to college, that is a way of saying that you're ready to talk about some really serious issues.
Being uncomfortable, being upset, being even a little bit offended is different than having a panic attack, blacking out, hyperventilating, screaming in a classroom, feeling like you're under such physical threat, whether it's real or perceived, that you act out violently in front of other people.
The National Institute of Mental Health estimates that about 3% of the adult U.S. population suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder. The mental health network Psych Central says that ordinary events can serve as reminders of the trauma and trigger flashbacks or intrusive images. That means almost anything in daily life could be a potential trigger for someone. But Loverin has a plan for that.
The way the resolution was written, it directed the Office of the Student Advocate, which I'm a part, to consistently review and revise this list with the assistance of the Resource Center for Gender and Sexual Diversity, the Women's Center, and the Counseling and Psychological Services on campus.
I've been working defending freedom of speech on college campuses now for 13 years. And the problem with creating a standard that's as broad and vague as the one that they're talking about at UCSB and the one they already have at Oberlin is it very quickly gets co-opted to limit discussion and to punish people who have points of view that you really strongly disagree with.
How far can the trigger argument be taken? Just a couple of weeks after the resolution passed the student assembly, a women's studies professor snatched a sign from some pro-life protesters and then pushed one of them away when she tried to take it back.
Can you pay? Don't touch me!
And she just pushed my sister as well.
I don't care!
Her stated reason for doing so?
What she argued was that the display was triggering. And it's an unfortunate part of human nature. If you give us a sort of an excuse to shut down speech with which we disagree, we're very quick to jump on that. You know, we see it as an opportunity.
So let's hear a little bit about the rest of that story, too, because it actually gets worse. There was a petition signed, it was an online petition, so take it for what it is, by 2,000 students defending the professor against the protester, saying that the professor is right, that she was microaggressed, and as a result, you know, we need these people to leave. And then it still gets worse, because the chancellor of the university, Michael Young, not the former UC Santa Barbara baseball player, Michael Young, but the chancellor of the university, Michael Young, issued this incredible letter in which he was talking about, you know, our founders gave us the right, our founders, by the way, who were all white men, seriously, it was this kind of language, gave us, you know, freedom of speech, and we should think about it. But what we really need to do is to beware of, quote, outsiders coming into our midst to provoke us, to taunt us, and attempt to turn us against one another as they promote personal causes and agendas. He just had a professor, one of his employees, shove a 16-year-old. I mean, this was a tiny girl. Shoved a 16-year-old anti-abortion protesters, take her property, rip it up, destroy it, and the chancellor is saying what we really need to think about is these outside agitators coming in and violating our space and being all divisive-y and such. For those of us with long enough memories, the phrase outside agitators in the UC system is kind of hilarious because the entire free speech movement, this thing that sprouted up at UC Berkeley in the early 1960s and kind of launched the new student left, some of which had some salutary effects and others descended into nonsense. But the free speech movement on Berkeley was all about being able to talk about politics, particularly war, on campus, which was not possible in the 50s and early 60s. And the people who tried to crack down on this, Clark Kerr at the time, and particularly this Bay Area legislator, nightmare person named Don Mulford, always talked about outside agitators. It's all these outside agitators coming on, they're communists, and they're gonna try to turn the youth. He launched a bill in 1965 to, quote, remove from the campus the professional agitators, the beatniks, the mentally ill, the untouchables, and the unwashed. I think Nick Gillespie is classified in every single one of those, or at least four of the five. So how in the hell did we go in a half century from, broadly speaking, the kind of campus left, rallying around the notion of a free speech movement that needed to, and did ultimately, expand the zone for free speech, to have these mealy-mouthed chancellors and also students and everybody else talking about trigger warnings and all these kinds of things. You can't read this slide, but I can, so that's why it's here. The 50th anniversary of the free speech movement was this, the beginning of it, was this year. And so the now chancellor of UC Berkeley, Nicholas Dirks, also issued an incredible kind of open letter thing, and I'm just going to read it because the language of this is... When I used to live in Central Europe, we talked about this thing called kommunistitski jazyk, in other words, communist language, which existed way after communism because people had been born and raised in this just awful, burying the lead kind of bureaucratic nonsense talk, and you could smell it from a mile away. And this sort of reminds me, it's not communist, but there's something to the language of this. Okay. As we honor this turning point in our history, this is for the free speech movement, okay? This is a big deal in Berkeley. As we honor this turning point in our history, it is important that we recognize the broader social context required in order for free speech to thrive. For free speech to have meaning, it must not just be tolerated, it must also be heard, listened to, engaged, and debated. Yet this is easier said than done, for the boundaries between protected and unprotected speech, between free speech and political advocacy, between the campus and the classroom, between debate and demagoguery, between freedom and responsibility, this guy went to the Barack Obama straw man school have never fully been settled. As a consequence, when issues are inherently divisive, controversial, and capable of arousing strong feelings, the commitment to free speech and expression can lead to division and divisiveness that undermine a community's foundation. Really, he said this. It's remarkable, and we see this around us every single day. Literally, in March, this kind of thought has led to, most famously, the two frat boys being kicked out of University of Oklahoma after tape emerged of them saying awful things. The UC Irvine student body banned flags earlier this month because flags are commonly, obviously, the American flag is the big offender here, are symbols of oppression and obviously, you know, might be able to trigger people. I was just, you know, on, for the sake of fun, saying, oh, I wonder if we have a college free speech headline on Reason.com this morning. We do. At the University of Oregon, an anti-abortion preacher had his sign forcibly taken from him by students who said, quote, this is not part of your First Amendment right, which is interesting. Gets worse. And then a police officer came by and he said, and this is all captured on video, I presume, what I'm here to tell you is that on campus we have additional rules other than just freedom of speech. So they're enforcing these new kind of things. So this happens every single day. We are seeing this. It's a new wave, unlike we have seen arguably since the late 80s and early 90s. So how do we get to this bizarre place? One way is that my generation kind of lost the fights. We were fighting, as I mentioned, all these kind of things. But as with the Sean Hannity, the result was he would get kicked out. And I'm no great fan of Sean Hannity, to say the least. But you should have his own for free speech. At the time that this was happening, all these discussions about how pornography leads to violence. And there was a new kind of crackdown on it that was widely noted. And at the same time, this was going hand in hand with the creation of ethnic and gender studies requirements, which doesn't necessarily cause anything, but these were seen by people, by activists, as two sides of the same coin. We need to crack down on speech and we need to mandate these things. The women's studies professor from UC Santa Barbara, that whole department existed because there was a hunger strike that I covered to establish the beginning of an ethnic and gender studies requirement and department at UC Santa Barbara. Another thing is that the PC thing that we all talked about that was making headlines everywhere in 1993 and such like that, it never died. I had Greg Lukianoff write an article for Reason about 5 years ago with that exact headline. I think the germ of that article became his great book, Unlearning Liberty. It kept going. The proliferation of campus speech codes went on and has continued on when people stopped covering it. It's like workplace drug testing. Remember when everyone was like, my God, they're drug testing at work. This is a big thing in the 1980s as journalists started having to be drug tested and they're pissed off about it. They'd write about it. At some point, since they all had to take the drug test, they stopped writing about it. And it continued. So PC And these speech codes and free speech zones and cages and things like that have been going on. And then also, I think that there's a new thing to observe. It's particularly in the age of Obama. I don't know how much of it is related to just the fact of politics that are surrounded around him. But Salon.com, which was founded in 1995, I believe, it was a very interesting publication back then. It was Camille Paglia, whose sort of career took off as a backlash against these kind of joyless, speech-restricting kind of things. She was a columnist for Salon.com. David Horowitz was a columnist for Salon.com. All kinds of things that don't make sense for those of us who follow it now. They saw themselves back then as a lot of liberals of the ilk of Bill Maher saw themselves. It's like, we're going to be politically incorrect. We're going to say whatever we want, and we're going to talk about sex differently, and we're going to be fearless. We're going to shut down the buzzkills on the left. Not shut them down, but we're going to, you know, demonstrate a new way of talking. This was much more kind of standard issue boilerplate left. Now that the Salon.com, besides running every single day, you know, why libertarians are the next Adolf Hitler, it's all identity politics. It's why this joke in the Academy Awards is problematic because, you know, hey, look, he asked the black woman to look at the box during the broadcast, and, you know, I actually talked about that on MSNBC for like 10 minutes. Actually, I didn't talk. I had my ear harangued about the problematic jokes of Neil Patrick Harris on the Academy Awards because he was making jokes involving black people, and he's not black. Even though he wasn't saying, hey, look at that black person. Stunning. So the New Republic, which has just undergone all kinds of different things like that, has decided that it's going to go down the Salon.com path. And so now, in addition to their Why Libertarians Are Hitler 2.0 articles, which are almost daily, it's all identity politics all the time. Arguably, the 2012 re-election of Barack Obama was very much fought not on any kind of record to defend, but on the sense that Republicans were coming after disfavored communities, women, minorities, and everybody else like that. So it has, that type of identity politics is just really noticeably swollen over the last 6 to 8 years in ways that I think have curtailed the zone for speech. So does it matter what people say on college campuses? I've always been of the mind that basically not. Maybe that's because I was kicked out of college for bad grades. But I don't spend a lot of time, you know, on college campuses. But I'm starting to believe now that the broader culture of free speech that has been emanating from there and that is sort of out there in the public has now caused things that are starting to harm the rest of us. I think we saw this with, for me, the real low point of the Obama presidency, besides the way in which Obamacare was passed and what it is, it was his speech in front of the UN in 2012, I believe it was, a couple of weeks after the Benghazi thing, where he says, you know, a free speech in the world must not slander the prophet of Islam. He said must. The administration basically blamed Benghazi on a crazy YouTube video by some rando dude in Cerritos, and they still stick to that largely as the reason for what happened, and it put him in jail, you know. So there's a real sense now, the notion that speech can be a trigger, can be a provocation, has entrenched in the State Department. Embassies and consulates were being sacked in Libya and in Egypt and in Pakistan. The State Department was sending out tweeting out serial condemnations of a YouTube video. They were under attack, and they were saying, we have nothing to do with this provocative YouTube video. It's insane to me. Charlie Hebdo, I think we saw this. And on the international scale, I think we're seeing a lot of backsliding on speech. There was that great and very moving, mass protest or rally after the Charlie Hebdo massacre in Paris, including a lot of, you know, free speech champions like the head of Saudi Arabia and Turkey. But even worse than that, I don't mind when people are feeling the need to pay tribute to stuff that they don't necessarily believe. I think that means that that stuff still is kind of winning. But the French government responded to this by launching a wave of arrests against people for Facebook posts, like scores of arrests. There's a clownish anti-Semitic comedian named Dieudonné in France, who walks around giving this salute called the Canal, which is made to look like the Nazi salute, but you can't actually do the Nazi salute. That's illegal in France. So he does this other thing. He's always like pushing the boundaries. He was arrested after the wake of Charlie Hebdo because he said, "Je suis Charlie," and then the last name of one of the guys who shot up the kosher deli. I mean, he's a terrible person, but to respond to this by cracking down on speech says to me we need to win more arguments broadly in the liberal West than we're doing. FCC net neutrality, I think, is actually sort of part of the whole concept that we've, right now, the left does not see the government as a problem with speech. Someone was telling me last night, and I'm gonna blow the anecdote, so I'll just drop it, but along those lines, talking to people, to me, it's astonishing that the very same people who defend Edward Snowden and who hate government surveillance then want the government to make sure that all of the internet is run like an electric company. It says to me that people have sort of lost the connective tissue between what actual censorship looks like. So I think that these micro campus trends are creating a bad sort of culture of speech that is worth talking about and fighting back against. And it's also led to a due process nightmare when it comes to sexual assault on campus and tangible laws. The Obama administration sent out a list of directives to college campuses tying funding with reducing the standards, evidentiary standards for kicking students off for alleged sexual assault. This has led to a wave of just awful due process cases of people who were not allowed to testify on their own behalf and all these kinds of things. Kathy Young wrote this story. It's one of the most popular stories we've run during my editorship about a year and a half ago here. And it's literally you're guilty until proven innocent here. And laws are being passed. California passed a law. New Jersey and New Hampshire are passing laws about affirmative consent, requiring, I mean, you have state lawmakers in Sacramento making lists of how one should engage in heavy petting on college campuses, the contracts that you need to sign. This is crazy. So since this is Reason Weekend and we are in California, I think it's important to note that there's some reason for optimism about all this stuff. Yes, it's bad, it's a backsliding thing. One thing is that this stuff is just not popular, right? Like it is, at some point it is inherently ridiculous when you can't laugh at Neil Patrick Harris making jokes on the Academy Awards.
Welcome to the 87th Oscars. Tonight we honor Hollywood's best and whitest, sorry, brightest.
MSNBC, which has turned its whole broadcast channel into finding perceived grievances against disfavored minorities, their ratings tanked, and now they're just firing people right and left and realizing that that was not a ratings winner. I don't know if you watched the Saturday Night Live 40th anniversary, which is pretty good. It was a great moment when Jerry Seinfeld came out. And Seinfeld's been criticized pretty heavily about how like he never had black people on the show and this kind of stuff. And he took questions from the audience, and he took questions from a black comedian, a woman who used to be on SNL, saying, addressing why didn't you have more minorities and other people represented. And he just said, yeah, our show wasn't about solving the world's problems. Next. There's a sense that, like, come on, are you kidding? It's not fun. I mean, when you're walking around policing jokes all day long, it's not an attractive pose to people. And I think that's no one loves a television show because it tries really hard not to offend people. I think we see the opposites of it. Another reason for optimism: FIRE literally wins every lawsuit it files, and it's filing more and more lawsuits. When Greg wrote his piece for us 5 years ago, he commented that of the 13 legal cases that they had taken about campus speech codes and these kinds of things, they had won all 13. 13-0 is a pretty good record. And I think that, I don't know if they've lost any major ones since then, but generally speaking, the First Amendment as a backstop has worked pretty well in these cases and will continue to, I think. Even the Harvard Law faculty has been protesting about the due process speech rights on campus as relates to sexual assault. So I think in the culture, these are winnable arguments. In the actual conditions, the legal conditions for speech, given the First Amendment, and also given a Supreme Court that is pretty damn good on free speech, most robustly we've seen in a long time, and just the stuff that, you know, the fact that it's not popular, I think there's plenty of reasons for optimism.